Hear that? It's the sound of you catching up on all the latest and greatest fintech news, trends, and updates thanks to Streetworthy, Yield Street's bi-weekly newsletter. Stay in the know with CEO Milind Mahiri as he takes a closer look at what's happening in the fintech space, then breaks down what each story could mean for investors like you. Give your portfolio the edge it deserves and subscribe to Streetworthy on LinkedIn today.
Welcome to The Yield, the official podcast of Yield Street. Every week, we bring you the latest market insights across our asset classes and products from subject matter experts. Our aim is to break the outdated mold of investing and help you add financial fuel to your ambitions through innovative investing products and strategies typically unavailable to most investors. Realize your next level with The Yield. Subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. The views you are about to hear do not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street. This podcast is intended to be strictly informational and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a research report, investment advice, or the offer or sale of securities or any investment product. Now, let's get into the show.
Welcome to another live episode of The Yield. Be sure to subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube, and leave a review if you enjoy the content. In case we haven't met before, I'm your host, Peter Kerr, and I'm the Director of Product Marketing here at Yield Street. Today, I'm joined by Adil Hassan, Associate Director of Real Estate here at Yield Street. A lot of you know Mitch Rosen, who has been on The Yield frequently. Adil works closely with Mitch and leads the diligence process of our CRE offerings, plus is helping to lead the expansion into CRE equity, which is new for Yield Street in 2021. Hello, Adil. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here, Peter.
Yeah, of course. And since the audience doesn't know you maybe as well as Mitch, you could probably start off by just giving a little bit of background, especially around your career and how you kind of got started and found Yield Street.
Yeah, definitely. So I've been in the CRE industry since I graduated college in 2013. I previously worked at JP Morgan in their CMBS group. So, you know, I was doing sort of like class A CRE assets. And then I found out about Yield Street, really looking at some ads and finding out about the key players who are involved in the fintech industry. And I reached out about a position here. And it seemed really exciting to me. You know, I was doing sort of very plain vanilla stuff. And when I came on here, it was sort of high yield bridge debt that I was doing, which was really exciting for me. It was sort of a new avenue in real estate. And it has gone really well. It has been sort of really fascinating to work on really interesting deals. Yeah, so I joined here in 2019. It's been about 2.5 years now, and it's going strong.
So it's interesting. You mentioned working on JP Morgan's CMBS desk, but CMBS sort of is a securitized version and an aggregation of a lot of CRE debt that gets repackaged together and sold off.
Exactly.
Can you maybe walk people a little bit further through, you know, some of the differences between single asset, single borrower, CMBS, and then also kind of what we're doing here at Yield Street?
Yeah. So CMBS traditionally has been sort of either it's like a one large loan, like $1 billion or $2 billion that Blackstone or the KKRs of the world are acquiring. And you package that, or the second side of the CMBS is sort of these smaller loans that are packaged together and sold as securitization based on the different risk profiles. Right. So it's a very institutional game. Not a lot of individuals or high net worth people really invest in these products. Very cookie cutter, right? Mm-hmm. It's going to be an office building on Park Avenue in New York, or sort of like a high rise building in San Francisco. So these are very cookie cutter. Everybody knows what they're going into. It's very stable asset class, especially if you're buying sort of the AAA tranches. But when I came here, it was a completely different ballgame, right? You can't really tick boxes, essentially. That's what it is on the CMBS side. If it meets a certain NOI, it meets a certain debt yield or debt service coverage ratio.
So really, I don't want to say little diligence, but compared to what you're doing at Yield Street here, kind of a completely different ballgame.
Yeah, completely different ballgame. I think it's been institutionally owned, all these assets that we did on the CMBS side. So you have sort of a track record and a history of how the asset has performed. When I came to Yield Street, you're looking at a completely different risk profile, right? There's usually a story there. There's usually some sort of hair in the deal. And just parsing through that diligence, it takes a lot of time and effort, and you really have to dig for the story. Mm-hmm. Like Mitch always says, whenever I go to him with the deal, he's like, let's dig for the story. There's something here that instead of a CMBS loan, which is priced at like 2-3%, So those warrant some additional risk, and you have to be cognizant of that and be comfortable with that doing a deal.
Yeah, I want to circle back on that, but I was just thinking, you know, analogous for listeners, a lot of them are probably familiar with their mortgages and how they get repackaged into mortgage-backed securities. Mm-hmm. This is essentially the analogy of this is for, as opposed to residential homes, this is for commercial assets.
Yeah, exactly right. So while I was at JP, we did sort of multifamily, office, industrial, so all different sorts of commercial real estate mm-hmm. assets. That's right.
That's great. And so you know, Yield Street has evolved quite a bit on the CRE side, and hopefully our listeners and those who are members on Yield Street has sort of seen an expansion into a lot of different types of lending. You mentioned when you come over here, you initially started off just in bridge lending,
yep.
right? But we've evolved to a lot of different types of lending throughout sort of the real estate life cycle.
Yep.
Can you maybe walk through some of the things that Yield Street was doing
yep.
and what they're sort of now doing? And then we'll certainly talk about the expansion into away from debt and also into equity.
Yeah, definitely. So that was the most exciting part for me joining Yield Street, right? I was able to do a lot more, basically be in different levels of the tranche in terms of the structure. So when I joined here, we were doing CRE bridge equity, right? That's a different from CMBS. Like I mentioned, CMBS is 3%, bridge debt is 8-9%, a lot more riskier stuff, but you have to get comfortable with the story. We also do preferred equity. We did mezz, right? So we are sort of playing in the debt side of the capital structure.
And maybe let's just pause there. Maybe you could quickly just walk through a cap structure that includes a lot of those different levels,
yep.
Just so people can follow along.
Yeah, definitely. So usually in a typical, say the deal, somebody is buying a deal for $100, right? Usually you have a first mortgage debt that's anywhere from 50% to 70%. Those are priced pretty low, like 6-7% for a bridge debt. For a traditional mortgage, it's anywhere from 2-3%.
And why is it priced lower?
Because it's a very stable asset, right? If you're buying an office building in New York, the risk is pretty low compared to if you're buying an office building in suburban Tennessee. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm just giving an yeah. example, right? You have a really heavy base of clients or potential tenants that you can go after in New York. You have a dynamic supply, not so much in sort of a suburban secondary or tertiary market. And then we played in the pref and mezz space, right? Pref and mezz is essentially the middle tranche between the first mortgage debt and the equity. And that is really so the sponsor can juice up their returns, mm-hmm. right? So equity will yield you anywhere from 15 to 25%. So they can put a pref piece from like 60 to 80% at like 9, 10%. And that really enhances the yield for the equity.
But so as you kind of track down this capital structure, you know, you're getting an incremental or proportional amount of additional return, but you're taking on a lot more risk, right? Maybe you could talk about, you know, how a cap structure works in terms of the risk that you're assuming.
Yeah, definitely. So if, you know, if a property is worth $100, right? If it deteriorates in value, if they lose a tenant, if the cap rates go up, there's a degradation in value. So in 2 years, if half the property is vacant, then your asset might be worth only $80, right? So if you're taking that equity position, that's the riskiest position. That's the first loss piece. Mm-hmm. If you're in the pref and mezz, which is say 70 to 85%, if the property value degrades even further, your piece is essentially eroded. So senior mortgage is sort of the most secure piece. Then it goes pref, mezz, and then equity. Mm-hmm. And the cool thing about working here and as we are sort of growing the platform is that we can play across the capital stack, right? We come across a deal, we might be really comfortable taking a pref position, but not equity position, right? Before we started our equity platform earlier this year, we would love a deal. We would want to take an equity position, but we couldn't. So it's really exciting to be able to look at a deal and sort of choose the tranche mm-hmm. that we want to be in. If you want to be equity, pref, first mortgage. I think that's the most exciting part of working at in the CRE business here.
Yeah, of course. I'd imagine from the team's perspective, you know, a deal, to your point, looks completely different on a relatively attractive basis based on how you played in the cap structure, where, you know, you might not touch a deal if you were coming as the equity piece, but you might love the deal if you're the senior mortgage in that deal.
Yeah, exactly. And that is sort of the pluses of having a platform that can provide first mortgage, mezz, pref, equity, right? Mm-hmm. We can choose our position in the capital structure based on the returns that we want, based on the risks that we are comfortable with, how we like the market, what does the tenancy look like? So a lot to play around mm-hmm. with, right?
Yeah. And so, you know, that's generally the different types of places we can play within the capital structure, but you'd also started talking a little bit more about, let's say, a bridge loan, as an example. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about some of the different purposes for why people are seeking to borrow, with bridge loans being one and construction loans and kind of along those lines.
Yeah, definitely. So if you look at sort of a stabilized real estate asset, right, the goal of any sponsor is to get the cheapest financing available. And the cheaper the financing for a first mortgage loan, the more return that they have on the equity side, right? So the goal of any sponsor is to get the cheapest 3%, 2% debt. But there is a position in a life cycle of real estate where they might be acquiring a property that is only 20% leased up and they need to get to 100% leased up, right? So they would take a short term, like a year long bridge debt at like 7, 8%. Get to a point where it's completely stabilized 90-100% and then go to a traditional bank and get like a 3% debt.
So you're essentially bridging through to the other side, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
And those tend to be very short term in nature?
They do. They tend to be anywhere from 6 months to 2 years, right? Very interesting deal that we did in Baltimore right now. It was a hotel that was shut down because of COVID. The sponsor that we're doing the deal with is acquiring the asset. The hotel is completely shut down right now. They're going to design, they're essentially going to convert it to multifamily.
Multifamily being apartments.
Yeah, yep. Multifamily being apartments. So they're sort of working through the design permits and stuff like that. And they need a year to do that. And this was a perfect fit for a CRE bridge loan. Once they get that, they're going to go out to the bank, get a construction loan or a renovation loan, convert it into apartments. And once they do that, they're sort of going to go and get a traditional bank debt at 2-3%.
So I guess, you know, is there traditionally a sequence in how all these loans might typically come in terms of the life cycle of a real estate asset? So does one usually start with a bridge loan as they are beginning and developing their plans and then transition once the bridge loan's complete, they refi it out for something like along the lines of a construction loan, and then they eventually end up with a first mortgage loan. So in those terms, is that kind of generally the life cycle of a CRE asset?
Yeah, I think so. I think if it's a new construction, you know, they're going to get a new construction loan at sort of like a 6-7%. Then they're going to complete the asset and then they need to lease up the asset. That's essentially where the bridge debt comes in, right? They're sort of, the building is complete, the construction has been done, and they just need to play the lease up game. And that's where the CRE, sort of the bridge debt comes in. And once they have achieved that level, then they can go and get a traditional 3% debt from a bank. Yeah.
And also in that example of like the sequencing, is it fair to assume then that, you know, again, the mortgage is essentially when the asset is stabilized. So therefore, you know, the return or the yield that you might get was proportionally lower, whereas a construction loan would be incrementally more risky and therefore provide a slightly higher tick up in yield. And then obviously a bridge loan being a little bit more risky because the project isn't really off the ground yet. Is that a fair characterization or?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair characterization. Yeah, as a lender, you're looking at the risk that you're taking, right? If the property is completed, it's 100% occupied, it has sort of a stable historical cash flows that we can look at, that's a much less risky product that you're doing, right? Yeah. So that warrants a very low yield. You'll probably do a 3-4% mortgage debt.
Yeah.
If it's in lease up or if it's in construction or if there's some issue in the property, then you're going to go for a higher yield bridge debt product and you're taking on that risk. And our job as CRE Yield Street team is to sort of dig into that story, right? What's the issue with this? What's the hair? Is it sort of a risk that we are comfortable taking on? Right. And also because the banks have a very strict criteria, like in CMBS world, certain metrics have to check off, right? It has to be sort of 65% of the value. The property has to be whatever, 80-90% occupied. We don't really have those metrics in the CRE bridge debt, right? We are sort of taking a position that, hey, the property is 20% occupied right now. What does it take to get to a 90%? Is it feasible? Is the market there? Is the demographic support that? Is there a heavy base of potential tenants that would be interested in this? So a lot more diligence goes on the CRE bridge loan than a traditional sort of a bank or CMBS loan. That's more of like a pricing exercise and competing with other lenders who might be bidding in the same ballpark, right?
And I think, you know, the thing that always sticks out to me whenever I talk to your team as well as other teams is, you know, everyone has to assume some level of risk in order to get compensated at you know, levels traditional for an alternative asset. Mm-hmm. It's really about what that risk reward ratio is. And, mm-hmm. you know, it's a little bit different in private markets than it is in public markets, where you can kind of just do a quick equation on the overall volatility of an asset.
Yep.
Whereas on the private side, it's really about understanding the sort of less tangible risk, right? And trying to figure out how to quantify what that risk is and whether or not you're getting compensated adequately.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's always a risk-reward scenario, mm-hmm. right? And even the CRE bridge lending space, if you look at it 10 years ago, it was like four or five guys who were, you know, the main players in the industry. The market didn't really know what the terms were. It wasn't widely circulated. As you look at it today, there are a bunch of bridge lenders out in the market, right? So that space has also become pretty competitive. If you look at the bridge loans that we were doing pre-pandemic, those were the same deal that were pricing at sort of like a 9-10% before pandemic. They are pricing at 6-7% now. So the market has become a lot more competitive mm-hmm. as the rates have gone down.
Yeah.
So I think it's a function of both assessing the risk reward and also being cognizant of what the other lenders in the market are doing.
Yeah, I think low rates is something that's permeating itself throughout the markets, both on the CRE side as well as just lending overall. We see, you know, the 10-year and 30-year at or near some of their historic lows. Mm-hmm. How do low interest rates really affect the real estate market? And what are some of the kind of the positives and negatives that come along with lower rates?
Yeah, definitely. I think looking at the current macro environment, right, we are at historically low rates. What that is really doing in the CRE industry is that it's encouraging sponsors to go out, either refinance the deals that they have that were much higher priced before, and now they can get much cheaper financing. And it's also a very attractive buy that a sponsor can go out there and get a very cheap financing at a very high leverage that really juices up their equity returns. Mm-hmm. So, and we have seen that over the last two quarters, the market is really hot right now. The cap rates are sort of at like a historic low, but there's a lot of people who are still buying a lot of assets. There's a lot of capital sitting on the sidelines waiting to be deployed. And we are seeing sort of a really, really hot market right now, where when we're doing sort of equity deals right now and we get involved with the sponsor, usually in their bidding phase, mm-hmm. right? And the bidding process is sort of crazy. There are hundreds and hundreds of bids out there. So it's very hard to win a deal, even in an environment where the cap rates are so low, mm-hmm. because people are really projecting sort of the rent growth. Mm-hmm. To be able to acquire an asset in today's environment where cap rates are in the, you know, if you go in the Sunbelt states like Texas, Atlanta, Florida, the competition is really fierce. You're seeing trades happen in sort of low 3% cap rate, which is historically really low.
Yeah.
So the only way you can get comfortable at like a 3% cap rate buy is that you believe in sort of the growth story of the rent, right?
Yeah. I want to come back to cap rate, because I'm not sure that's a term that that our audience is as familiar with. But before I do that, you know, you started to allude a couple of times to, you know, CRE's build out of an equity franchise. Historically here at Yield Street, we've been primarily a platform based on private debt.
Yep.
Certainly, you know, hopefully our members and users have seen our recent offerings in the equity space, which you know, everyone hopefully understands we're trying to do as many of as we can, but of course they have to meet certain criteria and we have to get comfortable as an organization. Mm-hmm. But really, you know, maybe you could walk us through the last 6 to 9 months or so and how, you know, equity has really evolved on the platform in terms of CRE.
Yeah, definitely. So we have been interested in doing sort of launching into the equity business for like 2 years now, almost since I started, right? It was sort of a process, and the brand we have built around Yield Street is really that we are asset backed, right? We are in equity side as well, but we are taking on a much riskier stance. Mm-hmm. And we really came to the conclusion when we saw deals where we would be really interested in being equity partners on that, but we couldn't do that. So it was a gradual progression in terms of getting comfortable internally. And like the first deal we did, that was like a $2.5 million deal.
Michigan.
Michigan, yeah. And the second one was $5 million. And that was really to test the demand on the platform, that do our users actually want to invest in equity? And once we launched those deals, we saw that our investors really want to do equity deals. And that is sort of how we really ramped up our equity business over the last 6 years. We did the Chesapeake, Virginia Industrial. That was $20 million equity investment. We did one in Pompano Beach. That was about $10 million. So I think this is a very exciting phase of CRE equity as we are sort of ramping up the business, taking on more and more deals. We are trying to cultivate relationships who have been in business for the last 20, 30 years, who have a track record. And those are the guys that we really want to partner with.
Can you actually elaborate on how a sponsor kind of participates in their involvement in, you know, essentially a CRE asset altogether, but kind of more particularly on how a deal might come on YieldTree and what a sponsor's role is?
Yeah, definitely. So the sponsor is essentially the one who is managing the asset on a day-to-day basis. So the sponsor will go out to the broker, they like an asset, they will bid on it, and if they win, they come to us, right? So typically a deal is capitalized, whatever, 60, 70% debt and 30% equity. Of that 30% equity, YieldStreet would provide anywhere from 80 to 90% of that equity stack, right? The sponsor gets a promote based on certain hurdles that they achieve.
Finding an asset with a lot of attractive fundamentals, which I do want to cover some of the fundamental aspects soon too. Mm-hmm. But also there's some capital injection and capital improvement plans that the sponsor undertakes by finding other partners and whomever they might be, all with the intent, especially in the multifamily space, to eventually be able to rent or lease those things a little bit later, right? So they do all that day-to-day management, which then takes it off your team's plate, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So we are sort of the silent partner, if you will. Mm-hmm. Not so silent because we have sort of the major rights, right? Like we agree upon a plan day one, right? Mm-hmm. We're going to invest, say, $5 million into renovating the units. Mm-hmm. The sponsor has to sort of follow that plan. They need to come to us if they want to change that plan.
Yeah.
But we are sort of sitting on the, you know, on the sidelines, just watching the sponsor do their business and just ensuring that they're following the plan and achieving the metrics.
Yeah.
And if they're achieving those metrics and if our cap rate predictions are right, then we sort of get to a number that is really attractive, right? And if we achieve those numbers, our investors are compensated for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's great. And so, you know, the team had obviously had a lot of experience on the debt side. Certainly, whenever you're underwriting a deal, even on the debt side, you're still very well aware of the economics of being an equity holder within that deal.
Exactly.
How has the team kind of transitioned from, you know, that debt mindset to also transition into, you know, having a little bit more of that equity upside, which is really kind of counterintuitive, where on the debt side, it's about not losing principal and receiving all your interest payments, where on the equity, it's really about that kind of optionality for upside.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said earlier, right, that's the cool thing about being at YieldStreet, that we can sort of choose the portion of the capital stack mm-hmm. that we want to be in. But you're completely right. Like even on the CRE debt side, we are really going for a fixed coupon, right? We have a lot of cushion, like there's 30, 40% equity behind us that is protecting our debt. So we are taking a very relatively safer position. We are going after like Class A multifamily in Pompano Beach or the industrial asset in Chesapeake, which is, as we all know, industrial market is really hot right now, really due to increase in e-commerce with the pandemic. So I think there's a different risk profile, but I feel like the deals we would do on the debt side, we wouldn't really do equity in those deals. Mm-hmm. I think there's a different segment of asset types that we focus for the equity business.
So I think that's great. And kind of what I want to go into next is, and you mentioned cap rate a couple of times, there's some other metrics you kind of alluded to, a loan to value on the debt side, but what are sort of some of the fundamentals and also some of the metrics that you guys do look at when evaluating and kind of modeling out potential future returns for a deal? And you can do both debt and equity if that's helpful.
Yeah, I think we are very cognizant of sort of the market is really hot right now, mm-hmm. right? The prices, as I mentioned, cap rate is really, the lower the cap rate, the higher the value, right?
But would cap rate be like a multiple? Is that how one thinks about it?
So cap rate, you essentially, if you divide the net income of the property by the
income
rate.
It generates, right?
The income it generates, essentially. That's your return on investment to think about that, right? So right now in the equity market, if you're going after the hot markets like Florida, Atlanta, Texas, your cap rates are really like 3 to 4%, right? That's a pretty low return for equity. So the only way that really makes sense, if you're getting debt that is cheaper than that, so you have to be, your debt has to be sub 3%. And then you have to really believe in the growth story, right? You have to believe that the rents are going to increase substantially that it sort of negates the impact of increase in interest rates that is bound to happen at some point and sort of the increase in cap rate. Yep. That's the only way sort of you can get comfortable with investing in these hot markets where the cap rates are so low.
Interesting. And so what are some of the other fundamentals? Like, you know, when you guys think about all the properties in the US, how do you kind of, you know, I know there's of course a relationship with the sponsor, right? Which is one way that we sort of see and source potential opportunities. But what's sort of the funnel or the criteria that you guys screen with to kind of, you know, parse through all the potential offerings?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think we definitely look at the asset types, right? Multifamily and industrial have sort of heavy tailwinds behind them. This is a very hot asset type. So we're definitely focusing on that because that has the growth fundamentals. When we're investing in sort of a multifamily asset, we look at the demographics. We look at sort of the what's the employment base around here? Is there job growth happening that can sort of absorb the increase in rent? When we do industrial assets, we sort of see what other companies are around there. What sort of potential tenants can come into that, and are they present in the market? Like for instance, we did the Chesapeake industrial deal. Mm-hmm. There's a huge Navy presence in the local market about 2 miles from there. So there's a lot of growth factor in that market. So aside from looking at sort of the cap rates and the interest rate, I think we really focus on sort of making sense that the demand and the demographic base support our investment. Mm-hmm.
And then so you know, you talked about location or, you know, regions on kind of a micro level.
Yep.
How do you think about them across, you know, the whole US, if you will?
Yeah, I think the three markets that I mentioned, right, those are definitely sort of the Sun Belt region. Mm-hmm. I think throughout the US, that is the area that is receiving the most amount of investments.
Mm-hmm. That's just general population growth migrating.
Yeah, population growth, sort of the shift in employment base. A lot of offices are relocating to these areas. Boston is another great example where life sciences is a huge driver of the market there. There's supposed to be 40,000 new jobs coming to Boston. And as we are all sort of aware that, I'm not sure if everyone is aware, but there's a huge shortage of housing in this country, right? So we're looking at multifamily investments in areas that have high population growth and high employment growth. And that fits really well with our thesis where we can be comfortable with raising rents.
Yeah. So it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, when I think about it from the perspective of an individual or a family, there's essentially three options. Mm-hmm. You buy a home to own.
Yep.
You rent a home, right? Mm-hmm. So not an apartment, or you live in an apartment or a multifamily, right? Those are the three primary, I think, you know, types of residences that someone could take.
Yep.
How would you kind of compare and contrast the attractiveness of all of them right now? And then also any effects or kind of like anecdotes from COVID that you expect to kind of continue to persist?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think home ownership is sort of the American dream. But if you're being realistic right now, there's been a huge disparity in wealth that is happening in America right now. The rich are sort of getting richer and the poor are sort of, you know, staying in that region where they can't really afford homes. So that's why they would either rent a house or an apartment. And this area, we expect that is going to grow tremendously over the next couple of years as people need some place to live.
Yeah.
Right. So we are seeing that growth in the SFR market as well. And we have a new hire on the CRE team, Tejas, who is sort of leading the SFR effort. And really overall, I think multifamily and the SFR side of the business is expected to grow at a substantial pace.
Yeah, with SFR being single family rental.
Single family rental. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I think multifamily and SFR sort of go hand in hand in terms of like rental product that that is essentially meant to act as a bridge until they can, you know, own a home. Mm-hmm.
And then, so, you know, there's obviously been migrations out of urban areas to more of a suburb or suburban lifestyle. How do multifamily or the SFR kind of work within that context? You know, does multifamily end up being a little bit more urban and SFR is a little bit more suburban, or you kind of feel as though there's kind of like swaths of both in both urban and suburban communities?
I think multifamily, you see both in suburban and urban markets, but I think SFR is more prevalent in the suburban markets. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah.
So, you know, kind of along that same that same thought, you know, if there is some migration out of some urban areas into the suburbs, how does that impact things on the CRE side as you think about it? I know you said you focus primarily on multifamily and industrial, but just for the other sectors that maybe aren't big focuses, what are those type of impacts going to be?
Yeah, I think we have, during the pandemic, we have seen people moving away from big cities, right, into suburban areas. We saw that in New York, we saw that in San Francisco, we saw that in Chicago. And these are sort of the markets that had the most trouble during the pandemic era, right? So you saw sort of the prices of suburban assets, multifamily increase in the suburban areas, while in the core urban markets like San Francisco is struggling right now because a lot of the people who lived there who had tech jobs in San Francisco as they went remote, there was no reason for them to pay sky high rents when they can go sort of an hour outside, rent a much bigger house, pay lower rent and work from home. So I think that's a trend that is going to continue. And I think it would really be dictated by how we sort of end up in sort of the live work environment, right? Do we come back to the office 5 days a week? That is going to sort of dictate how New York or San Francisco or like core Chicago multifamily does. But overall, I think you can see that in sort of Brooklyn market as well, right? Mm-hmm. Brooklyn market has been hot throughout the pandemic because people who work in the city, they can go out 30 minutes. They don't mind commuting for an hour for 2-3 times a week. So yeah, overall, I think suburban market is doing way better than urban market.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one thing you keep mentioning to me is that, you know, there has been significant or noticeable price increases in a lot of the multifamilies and other, you know, industrial assets that you guys typically look at. Yeah. What gives you confidence, I guess, really that, you know, you're paying a lot now. Mm-hmm. How do you get comfortable and confident around knowing that you're paying the right price now for that, you know, incremental or additional future growth?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. It's really dictated by GDP growth. If the inflation is a result of GDP growth, then we have sort of seen the value of the properties keep increasing. They're able to absorb sort of the rent growth because there's more economic output. What is not good in inflation is that really the cost of the goods is increasing, but our GDP output is sort of the same. Looking at it right now, our GDP growth across the last two quarters has been 6%. So just looking at those numbers, it gives us a lot more comfort that there's more economic output in this country and that the rent increases that has to happen for this investment to make sense can actually make sense, right? Yeah. People will be able to accommodate those rent increases.
Yeah. No, it all makes sense. When you kind of think about the whole real estate landscape as well, you know, are there other current trends that we haven't discussed that you think, you know, are top of mind for you all, especially as you guys, as you say, look for the story?
There are a lot of trends that are happening in the real estate market. But I think overall, it's really the shift to sort of the Sunbelt states, like high growth demographics that people are really targeting right now. Yep. Nobody, just like I said earlier, like, the rent growth story has to make sense for any investment you're buying in today's environment, right? So you have to pick and choose markets that can support that. So it has to be a result of either a lot of people moving into that city or sort of like a lot of job growth happening in that. So we are really focused on demographics, I think, overall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And then, you know, it's actually funny enough, a question that we always get asked after the show. People always ask, especially as they find people in unique careers, how, you know, you mentioned your path earlier into where, you know, you are now, but what are the recommendations you provide to people when they reach out and say, hey, how do I get into your seat? Besides discouraging them because it's competition.
No, I think you really need to get exposure in different real estate types. I think real estate is a very broad world, right? There's sort of SFR, which is single family rental. There's BFR, which is build for rent. But I think to anyone who is looking to join, looking to get more familiar with the CRE industry, I would encourage them to sort of look at the whole broader picture and how they sort of interact.
Yeah.
Right. Like even we mentioned interest rate and cap rates, inflation, and how they sort of interact with one another is really important if you want to get the whole picture of how the asset is performing and how it's going to do in the current macro environment.
Do you still subscribe? I mean, you know, traditional path for most out of college, at least, is to kind of go through a banking route, whether, you know, it's a large investment bank or, you know, just a mortgage underwriter, you know, regional bank, whatever it might be. Is that still kind of the typical path, or are things evolving now in a more, you know, kind of digital first environment or tech first environment maybe?
I think it was great. Personally, I would say it was a great experience for me to be sort of work in the banking environment. I think it was a great boot camp in terms of, you know, how the institutional world works, right? Mm-hmm. Being at Yale Street, we are way more hands-on. We are digging into the story. There's a lot of complexity in the deals that we do. But I think the banking role also prepares you for taking on this more riskier stuff and digging into the story. And really, you're way more exposed to the institutional side of the market being at a bank than you are at Yale Street, right? We are mostly interfacing with retail investors at Yale Street, a little bit of institutional as well. Mm-hmm. But I think those are two different sort of syndication paths or sort of the key players in the market. And I think exposure to both is really, really important. So you know sort of what is going on in the institutional side and what is going on the retail side.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So I got one last question for you, and we don't need to get into specifics,
okay,
but more broad strokes. What are you most excited about for the Yale Street real estate team heading into the fourth quarter? I guess end of year, we still got another month before Q4, huh?
Yeah, I think we are sort of expanding in all areas. That's the most exciting part. We are in SFR, we are in equity, we are in the debt product. I think that's really exciting for me.
And I'm actually just seeing a question came in. Yeah. The question is, please discuss the expected effects of high inflation and low interest rates on different value classes, CRE, multifamily, et cetera.
I think, like I mentioned earlier, right? Inflation is happening right now, right? That essentially results in sort of higher interest rate moving forward. And what I want to be cognizant of is that inflation in itself is not bad as long as there's sort of economic output, like a GDP growth. If there's GDP growth, then you can sort of see the rent increases that the market will be able to absorb. So the effect of higher cap rate doesn't impact your property values. But we are sort of very cognizant of that the interest rates are going to go up, the cap rates are going to get wider. That is going to affect value of the property. But we have to believe in the rent story. We have to get comfortable with that. And that's exactly what we do here. Make sure that the market can absorb those rent increases.
And there are also, you know, within CRE, there are asset classes that are more sensitive to rates, right? Some are able to pass it through more quickly. Some of them have to absorb them and kind of take a hit on the bottom line. Maybe you could expand on that.
Yeah, definitely. So like if you look at multifamily leases, right, they are sort of a year-long leases. So after a year, you can increase those rents easily. If you look at sort of the office, the leases there are 10 years to 20 years. So for able to increase the leases, you have to wait out 20 years. And if your interest rate is increasing, your cap rate is increasing, that is sort of deteriorating the value of your asset. So looking at the equity business, I would rather invest in something that has shorter term leases where we can increase the rents and sort of cover any depreciation in value due to increase in rent and cap rate.
Which is funny because the opposite of traditional office space is going to be actually hotels, because you think about it, you know, each day they can reset the prices to reflect their increased inflation or interest costs.
And it's really good news for the hotel industry right now, right?
It was just need travelers, right?
Yeah, you need travelers. There's pent up demand right now, and we're seeing sort of occupancy levels in hotels that is back to pre-pandemic level.
Well, you all have kind of been a little bit hesitant to get back into the hotel market. Are you guys starting to evaluate some opportunities there?
Yeah, definitely. I think looking at the beginning of the pandemic, everyone expected that there's going to be a lot of distress in the overall market, but we really didn't see that happen. And I think that's really a result of so much capital that is sitting on the sidelines waiting to be deployed, that there's, even if there's a little bit of distress, it's sort of, you can easily get out of it. There are tons of lenders who will refinance your debt. There are tons of buyers in the market who are looking for distressed deals. And, you know, we never really got to that distress phase.
Last question, and then we'll close out, is, in your opinion, what does the last quarter of 2021 hold for CRE?
Price stabilization. Yeah, I think the market has sort of reached the top, right? we have seen that over the last 2 months, where especially on the equity side, as we are bidding on new deals, we have sort of seen a price appreciation at a rapid pace, especially in the Sunbelt states. But I think we have sort of reached a point where, you know, the market has sort of capped out. And it is...
When you say capped out, it doesn't mean that the properties can't appreciate further. It just means the valuation you're paying for any property
now
is kind of done.
Yeah. I think, you know, like in Atlanta or Texas, things were trading at like 4 or 5 cap. Mm-hmm. Now they're trading at low 3 cap rate, mm-hmm. right? So I think that is sort of the bottom of what a potential buyer would pay for. Mm-hmm.
Okay, great. Adil, any closing remarks that you want that we didn't really get a chance to touch on that you'd like to say?
No, I think that was pretty much it. And thank you for having me on the show, and it was really, really fun.
Yeah, we were sorry to see that Mitch was unable to attend, but we really appreciate you stepping in. We thought you did a great
thank
job. So thank you.
Glad I was the second choice.
Thank you to all of our listeners. To listen to other episodes of The Yield, please visit and subscribe on Apple Podcasts, YouTube, and Spotify. For any questions on YieldTreat, please visit www.yieldtreat.com or email us at investments@yieldtreat.com.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of The Yield. For the latest updates on the alternative investing space, go to yieldstreet.com. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Stitcher. If you enjoyed the show, feel free to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, as this will help other investors like yourself find our show. If you have any questions, please visit us at yieldstreet.com. Thanks again for listening, and see you next week. The Yield Street podcast you just heard only reflects the opinions of the host, who is an associated person of Yield Street, and does not necessarily reflect the views of Yield Street or any of its affiliates or other associates. The podcast is for informational purposes only and is not intended to be and should not be construed as a recommendation to buy or sell any security, and is not an offer or sale of any securities or investment product. The podcast is also not a research report and is not intended to be and should not be construed as investment advice.
Support for this podcast comes from Yield Street. Trying to time the stock market can lead to regret. At Yield Street, our alternative investments are designed to create predictable secondary income streams, providing you with tools to help put your money to work immediately. These investments in asset classes like art, real estate, and legal finance typically have low correlation with the stock market and target annual yields up to 7 to 10%. Welcome to the next generation of investing. Welcome to Yield Street. Sign up today at yieldstreet.com.